Hello, good evening. I want to thank many people in this room for kind of an accompaniment that happened while I was in prison. It was very good to feel connected with so many people in the Chicago peace movement. And we have a friend named Sam Day, whom I have dearly admired. Sam died a few years back, who always used to say, "A prison, come on in, the water's fine," always encouraging us to take a turn inside prison, seeing it as a place of great education. And I don't think I'm ready to say the water is fine, but I did certainly think it was a spot for education, needed education on my part, to better understand who goes to prison and what's happening to people within the prisons, where they are so isolated away from the mainstream, and a throwaway the key mentality still obtains. Before I left, I was folding my towels in the laundry room, and Lupe came in, charming Hispanic woman, and she sat on the table and said, "Kathy, aren't you going to write about us before you go? Come on, ask me questions." And so I did start to ask Lupe more and more questions. I hadn't wanted to be nosy before or overly inquisitive, but she clearly wanted to tell her story. Well, as I was winding down to 2 days before I would leave the prison, it's typical for women to sing on, "Hey, Miss Kelly, 2 days and a wake up." Well, for Lupe, it'll be 53 months before she will hear those words, 2 days and a wake up. Lupe, who at a very young age fell in love with a fellow that seemed to have brought her into some severe problems with drug use and drug sales, she greatly repents that, wishes that she had never ever stayed in that relationship. But she's been in prison now since 2000. She hasn't seen her children since July of 2001. And her children are in Mexico, and she lives for that phone call that she can make once a week if she's got enough money on the books, earning 12 cents an hour. And they're now thinking about cutting the wages in half for women in prison. So I certainly am thinking a lot about the women whom I left behind. There was one day when I was sitting in the dish room. That's where I was assigned to work, and I'm a bit embarrassed about having accepted a work assignment, but I was waiting for the next meal, and I had a chance to linger over Seymour Hersh's article, one of several which have been such enlightening articles about prison detainees and about the Abu Ghraib scandal. And he wrote about how one company commander in the U.S. military assigned to the prison was asked by a junior military intelligence officer to please assign some of his troops to keep Iraqi detainees awake all night. And the company commander said, "No, I'm not going to do that because my troops under my command aren't trained for this. And if you give a group of 18-year-olds an assignment to keep people awake all night, they're going to start to get pretty creative." And so he, I think with perhaps more nobility than others expressed, said no. But I think we need to stay with that, to really think about that, because how would you train people to keep other people awake all night? Huh? And why would you do that? And is that the kind of thing that the U.S. military at places like the School of the Americas ought to be doing, to be training people to abuse the human rights of other people? And what a sad reality it is that we don't want to see our young people get creative, that in this age, when the Financial Times carries a terrible article about, I mean, it's well written, but a terrible reality about how a killer generation is the way that a new generation growing up is being depicted in an article that talks about how ready young US people were to kill. And here we are bamboozled into thinking that the only way to solve problems is to continue to rely on threat and force and our $437 billion military budget. Well, another take on what happens when our occupiers are moving into Iraqi neighborhoods was described in an article by a fellow named Michael Massing in the New York Review of Books. And he took exception to a person corresponding for National Public Radio and also writing for the LA Times, because as an embed, he only presented the military point of view when he and others had gone in, evacuated all the residents from a public housing facility outside of Fallujah, told people, "Sorry, we need your building," and then said to the reporter, the Marines said to the reporter, well, it's okay, because we're going to build a soccer field, and the people, when they come back, will probably feel just as good about having had a chance to get their units fixed up. We'll fix up these housing units before we leave. And there wasn't an opportunity for the embedded reporter to go out and ask more about this story, because it was such a dangerous reality, he couldn't go anywhere unaccompanied by the Marines. And this was in an article referring to the U.S. media as having flunked in the aftermath of the war and during the occupation and reporting to us. Well, I'm very, very pleased to be able to introduce Michael Birmingham. Michael and Andrea have taken a very, very different approach to asking questions and attempting to come close to understanding how to solve problems in Iraq. They've risked their lives, really, quite honestly, in a fashion which had us sometimes at the edge of our chairs in Chicago, hoping to hear particularly from Michael during some of the points when he was at the UN at the day when there was a blast there. And knowing Michael's persistence, I have worried for him, and yet at the same time I completely endorse and in a sense want to celebrate the courage that he has shown, the courage to ask questions. And in basic community development, the questions have everything to do with being respectful of other people. What are your problems? How would you want to go about solving those problems? Who in your community would you trust to be able to move towards solving those problems? And it can't be done in a drive-by fashion. It's something that takes time and takes the effort to study the culture and to study the language. And so I think we're quite fortunate to have with us tonight two people who represent a completely different kind of training. We're undertrained and undereducated in our country right now in regards to how to approach another culture in a way that wouldn't create terrorists faster than we can kill them, in a way that would really place trust and hope in the possibility of extending the hand of friendship, in a way that would not turn us into increasingly the feared and, if you will, the ugly American. I have felt sort of a commitment to keep in my own mind the urgency and the danger that we're facing at our time right now. And so I think it is good for us to one more time go over the litany. Some of you in this audience could trace back with me to your own younger years the string of wars. There was the Korean War, Vietnam, then Nicaragua, El Salvador, the tragedies that followed with Kosovo, the first Gulf War, Afghanistan, this most recent war. It seems as though we're primed steadily to be going from hot war to hot war to hot war, like little brush fires that we would try to put out, but underneath, undergirding all of that, is what I think could be understood as the war of Western culture against the planet, against Mother Earth. And we're so thankful to Dawn and the spirit of this bookstore for representing a different approach. And then also the war of US culture against weaker countries whose resources we want to control and exploit. The common denominator is our culture. And I think the demand upon us is, how can we change our culture? I think part of changing that culture is to be able to honestly and somewhat boldly and bravely identify what is criminal in our culture today. I'm not interested in putting anybody in jail, but if we want to see who the criminals are in our culture today, I think we have to look at those who are manufacturing nuclear weapons, conventional weapons, creating the readiness to use such weaponry, filling our water, our ground, our air with pollutants, and following public foreign policies that are creating so much antagonism toward the United States that we do begin to feel less and less secure. This is the kind of threat that we would do well to concern ourselves with. But Lupe, the other 299 women that I've spent the last 3 months with, I just want to tell you all, take a deep breath and relax, because I haven't met the bad sisters, not in maximum security prison, not in minimum security prison. And if anything, I think the more sisterhood and brotherhood that we can have with those who have been among the most disadvantaged in our society and who are the victims of a war against the poor, the better for us. And one of the best ways to help steer people away from going into the prisons is to divert that money that's been put to work in Iraq for destruction, killing, maiming, orphaning, and creating hatred and greater fear, to demand that those resources be directed toward creating a better world, which our young people surely do deserve, so that no one ever would be referring to the young resources, the best that we have, our most important resource, as a killer generation, but rather as a lover generation. Thank you, and I'm happy to introduce Nicole Bowman. Mr. Ireland.
Yeah, you're probably going to figure that out very quickly. Thanks, Cathy, and hopefully I won't get lost and speak so long that that you all get bored to tears, and also because maybe Cathy and Andrea, you know, are, you know, far better placed than me to actually speak about many things, and you know, Cathy is has been working in Iraq for very many years, and working here in the U.S. for many years on this issue. So I think it'll be good to have time for at the end for questions. I hope for another reason than that I'm not necessarily the best place in the room to speak about this. So the other thing I feel a bit strange about being up here from is, of course, I'm not well placed to speak about Iraq for another reason. And you know, while I've been in Iraq since October 2002, when I went over with Voices in the Wilderness, maybe a bit more than a year and a half ago, and been there pretty well nearly all the time since. I'm not from Iraq, and the limitations on what I can say because of that, I don't think even, I don't know if any of us can really appreciate. I don't think, certainly, my sense is, having been there, is that I haven't even begun to understand the ways in which being in Iraq all your life qualifies you much better than any of us to speak about the reality of that issue. And unfortunately, this debate, which has relentlessly gone on since September 2002, when President Bush pretty well let it be known to the UN and to the world that he was going to invade Iraq, which it's been, I think yesterday, maybe the Chicago Tribune, the New York Times, USA Today, all had a different story about Iraq on the front page. You know, if you look at the television stations, NPR, Fox News, we're listening to analysis and stories about Iraq all the time for more than a year and a half. We're listening to Americans tell us about Iraq and debate with each other about Iraq, and Westerners report in from Iraq about Iraq, and whether those people, and for the most part they're people who go to Iraq for a few weeks at the most, whether they're journalists, or whether in the past they're UN workers, or whether they're politicians like President Bush, who put his toe down on the tarmac and jumped back on the plane, or Paul Wolfowitz, who's done more or less the same thing, only does it more often, so he can be on the airwaves more consistently, or whether they're Westerners from humanitarian organizations, or whether they're people like me from organizations like Voices in the Wilderness. There's incredible limitations on what we can understand or see or say or experience about Iraq. So maybe I want to start with that. And one experience I'm going to begin with is something that when you spend some time in Iraq, you get to hear about quite a lot, and you get to realize that this has made a very terrible impact on the people and their thinking. And that was the war that happened between Iran and Iraq in the 1980s. I guess to begin with, just to give you some sense of that war, it went on, I guess, through the whole of more or less Ronald Reagan's presidency. And it was from 1980 to 1988, you know, maybe the end of 1980 to 1988. And during that war, 1 million people died, and many millions of others were badly injured. And when you go around Iraq, you know, you see people on the streets, on small trolleys, like more or less like kind of put together basic skateboards, who've lost their legs and crawl around on their hands on these things, on pavements that are broken up, if there's pavements at all. And because people haven't got the money for wheelchairs. You know, you see this quite often. Many, many people, I know another man who has a plate in his head because of injuries he received in that war, and lives in a house with no air conditioning or fans, and it gets to more than 50 degrees Celsius, which is, I guess, more than 115 degrees Fahrenheit, I think, if you can imagine how hot that is through the summer in Baghdad, and the pain that he lives with without medicine, you can't imagine. There are so many vicious injuries, 1 million dead between Iran and Iraq, maybe more than 500,000 in Iraq alone, which is a country of about 25 million. Whereas in the US, if you think of during the Vietnam War with the population now of 280 million, you had maybe a tenth of those numbers of people killed. But if you think of the millions more that have had crippling injuries, it was a war in which people, in which the Iraqi government used poison gas. We have been told that this war was to find weapons of mass destruction, and now I think I don't need to speak about that, you know, about, you know, how patently dishonest that was. But during the 1980s, Iraq did have these weapons. We know it because we gave these weapons to Iraq. And they used them in Iran in 1983 and 1984 when Donald Rumsfeld was visiting with Saddam Hussein, as you probably know. He'd already been told that they were using these weapons. So I don't know how I can speak about Iraq better than somebody who lived through one of those attacks. How I can speak about it better than one of the Iraqi soldiers or one of the Iranian soldiers on the battlefield or one of the Kurdish people in villages that were hit with these weapons in 1988. And if you remember also, Colin Powell and others in the US administration have gone to Kurdistan and tried to almost use this as a justification for the war, that the Iraqi government was using these weapons against the Kurdish people. It must seem somewhat deeply ironic to the people who actually died or who ended up being taken to hospital in Iran after the poisoning that the US government at the time continued through all those years. It knew in 1983 that gas was being used in the war. It knew, and all the way through 1988 when it was used in Kurdistan, it made no difference to US policy of supporting both sides in the war. I don't know if I was an Iraqi asked the question that journalists like to ask when they go over there and like to try and answer in their articles, you know, well, is it better under Saddam or is it better under occupation? I don't know if I was an Iraqi how I would come about trying to actually answer that question, thinking about, you know, Saddam having called up my brothers to war, and maybe my brothers trying to go into hiding, as so many did, and being hunted down by secret police and imprisoned and tortured and maybe killed because they didn't go to the war, or if they were caught and taken off the war, sent to the front line to be killed or to be severely injured, fighting against people that many times were also, you know, were more their brethren in some respects than, you know, than they would have felt of Saddam. I don't know how he would feel. Do I think it's better under Saddam? Or do I think it's better under the people? And what, you know, who the US government you're talking about? Well, what was their attitude to that war? Well, let me tell you, if you remember Henry Kissinger. Henry Kissinger said of the policy of the Reagan government in the 1980s towards the war. He said our policy was to let them kill each other. You know, let the Iranian and Iraqi people kill each other. Paul Bremer, who has been in charge of Iraq with dictatorial powers since last summer, up until about a week ago. Paul Bremer, who was previous job was head of counter-terrorism during the period in the 1980s when these other wars that Cathy talked about, when the US supported the Contras in Nicaragua as part of this counter-terrorism strategy, in Guatemala, in Honduras, and indeed Honduras, where the new person who's taken over was also previously in charge, John Negroponte. But Paul Bremer, who was head of counter-terrorism when counter-terrorism amounted to supporting proxy militias to murder and terrorize human rights workers and journalists and the poor generally in these countries, and who the Washington Post described as the most powerful overseas American since Douglas MacArthur. Paul Bremer on PBS said in 2001 of that the policy, our policy was to get the Iraqis to kill the Iranians, and I think that was a good policy. They are the exact words of Paul Bremer. And so for that reason, the US government gave intelligence to the Iraqis when they needed it to keep them in the game, not to get them ahead, but just to keep it as a stalemate war. Gave the Iranians weapons in the Iran-Contra affair, as you probably heard of, and did many other things just to keep this stalemate, vicious 8-year war going. I guess I don't know how I would feel about that, or if I was one of the people in Radwaniya. And Radwaniya is just a place outside Baghdad. And when I went, I was in Iraq, you know, through maybe the first 9 days of the war and before it. And I had to, I was asked to leave halfway through the war and came back in though, in a few weeks later in April after the US occupied Baghdad. And one of the first things I did was I was trying to track down some people who were missing in the war, who were taken into US custody and their families didn't know if they were alive or dead. And I went out to around US bases because no US base was able to give me any information, just say, well, try the others with the name. So I went around looking with a taxi driver, and I went out, as I was driving out just on the outskirts of Baghdad, I came to this place, Radwaniya, and I seen at the side of the road as I was driving people in the distance in the countryside with diggers just standing around, old women and men. So I decided to stop the car and walk over to them and ask them what they were doing. And they told me that they were they had a digger, they'd hired it themselves and had this an old digger and an old bus, and they'd come up from the south, and they told me they were looking for their sons and their sons mainly, who they thought were buried there. It had been a prison. And in 1991, after the uprising that took place in the south of Iraq, the sons of these old people disappeared. And they'd been since told, it had been rumored they were taken to this prison. And afterwards it had been rumored that they were killed, and they were. One of the men there had been a prisoner, and he showed me he showed me these tiny cells where people were crammed into, and the hooks on the ceiling that they were tortured from, and how he was one of the only people that was managed to survive. And there was no Americans there, no American soldiers documenting this. Saddam Hussein is on trial at the moment for war crimes. There was nobody there documenting it, because I asked him, why are the US not here? Why are you doing, do you not think it's better to try and get some independent human rights monitors or from the, coalition, from the US or other forces to document? They said, we asked them and they weren't interested. So we're going to do it ourselves. We just want to find out if our relatives are alive or dead. They don't care. The US authorities don't care, so we're just going to do it. And I don't know how I would feel if I was one of them, like this old man who told me about his son who disappeared. He was a teacher in the south of Iraq. He was in school in April of 1991. And on the bus home from school, the secret police got on the bus, they took him off, and he was never seen again. I don't know how I'd feel if I was that man's father who was there, or one of the people who I talked to who lived nearby the prison, and these poor farmers who lived there. And they told me that in 1991, they remembered the lorries coming full of people to take to that prison. How would I decide whether I was happier under Saddam, or if I was happier with an American occupation? Because, of course, what was the US government's response at that time? Well, if you remember, George Bush Sr. had actually called for that uprising. He'd asked the people of Iraq he told them, this is their time. And so they believed him. They believed him when on the radio he said, this is your time. And so they uprose. And they took over the entire south of Iraq. Basra, Nasiriyah, Kerbal, and Najaf, these cities in the south, most of the country people took over in the south. And then what was the response of the US military in the region? Another man I know who's actually in exile living in Ireland was one of the Iraqis who was living there, involved in the uprising, and many of his colleagues were killed as US planes hovered overhead and under and watched and did nothing as Iraqi government helicopters were allowed to come and massacre people. The US government allowed this to happen. The man that's been vilified as the excuse for the latest war and vilified back then was supported to remain in power. How would I feel? Well, many Iraqi people are extremely angry about that. They're not stupid. They know that they say to you, you want to come for liberation? Well, many people say, it's 13 years too late. We didn't need to be liberated. We liberated ourselves back then. And the US government had encouraged us to. And when we came out and did it, we were massacred. I guess There's many other realities of occupation Iraq that are worth thinking about. Other realities like the kind of fear that was there in that country. When we were in Iraq before the war, people couldn't speak to you freely. People couldn't speak to each other freely. You couldn't even speak in your own home. Like people would tell you now, they tell you stories about how, the way that the Iraqi government worked was that it realized that that people were going to fight and give their lives for justice. Because people had done that for years. This government was in power for more than 30 years. And always there had been Iraqis who had rose up either as part of the Communist Party or other left-wing organizations, or as part of the Dawa Party, a religious party, or other Shia Islamic Muslim organizations who fought for their communities and their freedom and their families. And the Iraqi government knew that simply torturing these people, as it did on a huge scale, and still you meet people very often who show you the marks and the places underground where they were held, they would risk that torture, they would risk being killed. And but so the Iraqi government chose to actually have a strategy that if you actually had any form of, showed any form of criticism of the government, not even taking up arms or actively opposing it, simply having a beard in a Shia Muslim area, which would signal like some form of independence from the government, you could risk your family being taken away and tortured or killed. Any form of dissent from the government would not just doom you, because people would be brave enough to risk that and had been. So you'd have to know that you would doom your family. That was the reality of fear that people lived with, not knowing that in your own home that the child, you know, maybe if you speak against the government, your young child might not be old enough to realize that if they say anything that you'd said the night before, they could be getting their older brother or their father taken away and killed. So you don't even speak freely in your own home. You don't speak freely to your friends in case they're coerced under torture to say something about you, or in case they make a mistake. That's what people have to live with. And sometimes it's interpreted as paranoia. Kathy was just talking earlier about the FBI's particular ideas of the Arab mind. And we actually found a book on the book market from the Department of Defense, which describes itself as the official US intelligence agency's understanding of the Arab. And it's, you know, from, on the one hand, saying that it's the guide to Iraq that people had just before the war that the Department of Defense gave out. And in the guide to Iraq, they describe how, because of the harsh, extreme climates, Arabs are always inclined to extremes in opinion. But it also describes the paranoia that people feel. Well, of course, I'm not qualified to explain how it's not paranoia to actually realize that so many things that you can do, from even organizing like a food run in your community, because you might organize it, you have to organize it with other people, and that's organization, and therefore a threat. And a food run, therefore, could be a threat to the government. And not only might I get tortured, I might get doomed my family. So this is not paranoia. You know, this is people being responsible for their families and their communities. And that's what people in Iraq have had to live under. And we may say again, well, thank God. Well, that's evidence that it's better now than before. At least that's gone. But then we have to remember, well, what was this regime that produced such incredible fear amongst its entire population? And what was the attitude of the US government towards it? Well, firstly, the Ba'ath Party, which came to power in the 1960s, you know, partly as a result of CIA involvement in the overthrow of the previous government, which it didn't like because it was nationalizing the oil and nationalizing other industries. And thank God, like this time round, Paul Bremer was able to come in and try and sell the entire state off. But it didn't quite work for some reason. But the Ba'ath Party came to power and was supported actively. And in 1991, when the uprising of the Iraqi people was allowed to be put down, when President Bush decided not to actually overthrow Saddam Hussein, but to make sure he stayed in power, the reason was that they did not want rid of this. And this policy did not change until the very last moment before the war. If you remember what President Bush said on the 17th of March last year in 2003, he said that Saddam Hussein and his two sons have 48 hours to leave Iraq. What does that mean? If he left Iraq with his two sons, we leave the government in power? The people who, the same regime that have kept people tortured and murdered, we leave them in power? Yes, because we've always supported them. We can do business with them, but we're tired of the guy at the top. And repeatedly, during the 1990s, US governments, Democratic and Republican, have committed themselves to the same policy, leave the Ba'ath Party in power. Before that, in the 1980s and 1970s, we did business with the Ba'ath Party and left them in power. And did business with Saddam Hussein and kept them in power. And that's why Donald Rumsfeld was over there re-establishing diplomatic relations with Saddam Hussein in 1983 and 1984. But we got tired of Saddam Hussein personally when he became a bit discommoding in 1990, but wanted the same regime left in power. So how do you ask the Iraqi people, how does someone answer that question? Anyway, I'm flogging a dead horse, I've said enough about that. But I want to talk not just about the US government's position, because I think those of you who've come out tonight here in Chicago are probably far better aware than me, and I've only realized I've heard about Fox News when I was in Baghdad, and I only realized, having had the opportunity to listen to it last night and today, what a wonderful education you get about the world by tuning in. So I'll say no more about the US government to people who know more about it than me. But I want to talk about the alternatives. I want to talk about, for instance, who do we go to then to try and sort out Iraq if we can't rely on the US government? Well, I think some of us might think about the United Nations. And I want to briefly talk about the United Nations from my experience. I volunteered for a little while with one of its organizations in Baghdad before the war. And I had some other ongoing relations, meeting with the people who were in charge of its programs. And one of the things that's apparent, but I don't want to talk about it from the point of view of being a volunteer, I want to also talk about it from the point of view of somebody who isn't actually a Westerner or a visitor to Iraq, but again from the point of view of somebody who is Iraqi. And unfortunately, like I say, I can only do that to a limited extent, because I haven't spent my entire life as Iraqis have done. But what do you see of the UN? What did you see when it was there? Well, you would have seen people driving around in brand new sport utility vehicles. You would have seen people living in hotels, expensive hotels, moving from one hotel to the other hotel. And I think this is not specific to Iraq, and it's not specific to the United Nations. It's the way we tend to do business when we in the West go overseas to help the poor. It's also how we tend to do business when those of us from the middle classes in the West tend to go across town to the poorer areas to try and help out a bit. And part of it is the fact of life. But that's what you see. And if you're one of the vast majority of Iraqi people who lives in incredible poverty, with maybe one toilet, one hole in the ground, with no water in your home, with many people sleeping in one room, you know, etching a living from a basic food ration that's worked out to give you the minimum number of calories and set to survive. And you might remember that part of the reason that people live in such poverty in Iraq was because of United Nations sanctions on that country. And you might not want to very well appreciate that some people in the UN driving in these SUV vehicles don't have much say over the Security Council. It's the UN, you might think, from your perspective, being an ignorant Arab, I think, as the Department of Defense might say. You mightn't appreciate all the little differences in there. The United Nations approved sanctions on Iraq in 1990 and kept them in place through the entire decade, long after its own agencies had said that these sanctions were killing hundreds of thousands of Iraqi children. Long after, not just its own agencies had said this, but the US government, for instance, Madeleine Albright in 1996, was asked on television whether the price was worth it for so many deaths, and she said it was, an acknowledgement that the US government knew, whatever the exact figures are, that it was killing and starving this country, the poor, while keeping the powerful in place and not affecting their lifestyles and swimming pools, the very small minority up around Saddam Hussein, it was destroying this country. So, and You know, when I was also in the United Nations, as Cathy said today, that it was bombed. And so I don't mean to suggest that, that everybody in the United Nations, all 38,000 or so employees, are in any way bad or incapable. But what I want to say is, as an institution, is this an alternative to help Iraq? Is it capable as an institution of helping Iraq? And I only want to take the United Nations as one example. You can talk about other foreign governments. We can talk about other international institutions. I don't think it matters. It's an example. And I think they all suffer from the fundamentally same analysis and the same problems, the same reality that goes on. When the UN was bombed in August 2003, it pulled out its organization. But the day it was bombed, and in the months leading up to it, the workers were under strict orders never to leave their workstation, never to leave that building they were ultimately, many of them, killed in, and only to do it if they were in two-vehicle SUV convoys, and not even to roll down their windows driving through Iraqi streets, and never to stop, even to go into a shop, never to talk to Iraqis on the street, but only to go, if they had to go, from that hotel, which was guarded by US troops and Humvees, not just with heavy submachine guns, but actually missiles trained in every passing car, and internal security, only to leave that and go to another hotel, similarly guarded, if necessary. And those people that died many of them knew that they were taking risks in Iraq by being there at that time. I'd been around the restaurant in the UN in the time leading up to that, talking to some UN employees I knew who were saying, "This is ridiculous. We're going to get bombed." You know, already two vehicles had been attacked, two UN vehicles in the month prior to this. And they knew that security was useless, that the American troops were just using heavy weaponry and had no idea what they were doing. So they took risks and they paid for it with their lives. But what I'm saying is that there is no room in that organization institutionally for courage. And why I say that is because the notices that were up on that board in the United Nations told people, if you don't adhere to these conditions and stay in this hotel, or move from the policy of driving around only in SUVs, you will have no insurance. You know, they're warned, basically. And after August, people were not allowed return. Individual UN workers were not allowed return to that country. And many, of course, would want to. And the policy high up of Kofi Annan was to say that if the UN can provide protection for the if the US can provide protection, then we will return. But many people in the south of Iraq told me, I spoke to tribal leaders and to other people in the south, and they said, "Really, you know, why did they not come here? And I, you know, why is the UN not here? Why are other Western organizations not here?" And I said, "Because they say it's not safe." And they said to me, "But we can provide, we will provide security for them. But does the UN engage with this?" No, it says to the occupation force that you must provide security for us, as if it can when it can't even protect itself, as if it has any legitimacy after going in illegally in a war that was mandated under no international law. So I think, you know, that what's that saying is, maybe as we have with the army, if people don't want to go to war, they often, you know, many of us fight for the right for people to object conscientiously. There is similarly very little opportunity for individuals in an institution like the UN to have a conscientious objection and say, "Well, actually, I object to institutional cowardice and I want to go back and work with the people in the way that I want." There's no scope for people to do that individually, any more than there was much scope for any individual within the UN to not be part of. The sanctions were done in all our names, in everybody's name. And so I guess that I'm waffling. The last thing I want to ask about is, is whether we're the answer then. If international organisations, and I think what I want to say about the UN, of course, is that what we're dealing with in Iraq is a climate of absolute fear. It's fear that you'll lose your life if you do anything, if you walk around the street. That's what Iraqis live with. That's what they've lived with for 30 years, and it's what the occupation brings. Like I said, if you organise at all, even basic social service, I'm not talking about heavy political overt or opposition to the government. If you organise at all in that country, before the war and after the occupation, you're risking your life. So we're saying to Iraqis, in order to rebuild our country, they must show the courage to risk their lives to do not just basic social, you know, services. They have to actually go and oppose an unjust occupation. They have to do all of this. And can we help, as we seem to incessantly assume we can, whether we're on the right who invades our country or on the left and thinks, no, it shouldn't be the Republicans there. Maybe it's the Democrats that would be better, or maybe it would be another government or maybe another institution. But the West, we have the answers. We're the ones that know about human rights. And I think that is the core issue, is that we have come to a country enveloped in fear and brought to it more violence. And is there another alternative to fighting fear without having courage? And have we displayed ever yet courage that the Iraqi people must show every day of their lives to just get by, when our institutions, from the US, which bombs it, the US government's position of bombing with shock and awe from thousands of feet up in the air, to the UN's refusal to actually talk to people on the ground after it's engaged in 13 years of sanctions, which nobody in the UN pretty well agreed with, no nation state, none of the individual organisations like the UNICEF, UNDP, or its Secretary General, but simply the US government imposed it. No one was willing to stand up and refuse to deal with it. Have we got shown any form of courage that we think we can go into this country with these people who've lived through all of this and we know better and we're able to help? And I wonder whether the question applies to all of us, not just to our institutions. Have we shown the courage in our opposition to an occupation that I think is becoming clearer and clearer, from the pictures in Abu Ghraib, to the massacre in Fallujah, to the massacres in Sadr City and Basra, to the refusal of the US government to bring any kind of alleviation to the massive poverty that itself had created in Iraq through the sanctions, by bringing in any form of aid to the country other than the profiteering of Halliburton and Bechtel, which is where the vast majority of the so-called humanitarian money that's been brought in has gone. Do we feel that our opposition here in the United States to these oppressive policies that we know are wrong, and I assume by coming out here tonight the majority of you know that this occupation is not a liberation of the Iraqi people, do we feel that the courage we have shown in our opposition is in any way something we can be proud of? If I wasn't a Westerner, an Irish guy standing here tonight, but if I was actually someone who was from Iraq, whose children, whose family were living in Sadr City, who were living under poverty, who had suffered and had their lives destroyed and crippled by fear, not just by a vicious Iraqi dictator and his regime, but by our vicious regime, which has supported him and which is now directly in control of my country. If I was an Iraqi, would you feel that we as Americans, as Westerners, would be able to say, well, I did everything in my power to stop the destruction of your country? Or might we feel, well, actually, coming out on the 15th of February 2003 is not quite all that we're capable of, and a few people doing civil disobedience is not quite the pinnacle of our abilities as human beings to think about a way of opposing this government whose foreign policy is not just vicious in Iraq, It is vicious around the world, just as its domestic policy is vicious within the United States. And would we be confident to say that all we plan on doing for the next year is to come out this November and to take one vote for some guy other than Bush, and that's it, that's enough, you should be grateful? I don't think we would. Thank you very much.